All right, welcome to the Sports Med broadcast. We are here talking with Dr. Alfred Mansour. Thank you for that power hour of hip information, Dr. Mansour.
My pleasure.
Let's start with the first talk that you talked about, the epiphyseal injuries in adolescent athletes. Kind of give me a rundown of what that talk was about.
Sure. So try to pick out kind of the most important things if you're taking care of the young athlete. So for sure, first we started with the growth plate, just looked at the different types of injuries, differentiating them from going into the joint. So the ones that go in there are the type 3 and type 4, Salter-Harris, versus the ones that go outside of the growth plate, type 1 and type 2. Then we moved to the throwing shoulder, looked at kind of overuse injuries of the shoulder, which would be epiphysealisis or little league shoulder. Then we marched down to the elbow, and we looked at an avulsion fracture of the medial epicondyle, which, again, you see medial elbow pain in your throwers. Then we looked at more of the chronic medial elbow pain, which is the apophysitis or the little leaguer elbow, related in some part to overthrowing, curveballs, year-round pitching. Then we moved to the lateral side of the elbow, where we looked at an overuse injury of the subchondral bone called an OCD.
So you mentioned the gift that keeps on giving. Can you
expand
on that a little bit for me?
Yeah, I love it. It's the gift that keeps on giving that really you don't want. It's like the white elephant party. So specifically the growth plate injuries and in kids that have not gotten past their peak growth velocity. So these are your 9, 10, 11-year-old kids that are, you know, 60% of what their height will be, 70% of what their final height will be. And so if these kids get a growth plate injury, if it's either not recognized, and sometimes perfect treatment has been given, and they've had such an injury to the growth plate that it shuts down. Either part of the growth plate will shut down or the whole growth plate will shut down, and that can lead to not an immediate issue. So they'll get back to running, jumping, playing, most of these kids, and then 6 months, 1 year down the road, we'll notice the implications of it, which would be my leg is now bowed and it was straight, or I now walk with a limp but it doesn't hurt and it's my leg's actually shorter. And usually we see it in the lower extremities because you're walking on it. And so the upper extremities, you may have a difference, but you're not, you know, walking on your hands, so you don't care about 1 centimeter. You notice that your shirt sleeve's a little bit longer on that side, but that's the extent of it.
Mentioning the Salter-Harris type 1, type 2s, why is it that, well, when you have those, are you seeing those more often rather than the ones that go into the actual growth plate? And then what are some of the examinations as a PT or an athletic trainer that we should be kind of keying in on before we refer out, or if it's just, hey, you know, this guy needs some rest and recovery?
Yeah, so great question. I think that, you know, being on the front line and not having x-ray is difficult for some of these acute injuries. So what I would say is it's rare for a joint injury to have a bunch of swelling around the bone. And so when you look at it and you just, you know, think about your anatomy, if they're complaining of a wrist injury, and you can still kind of see the outline of the wrist tendons and the, you know, the snuff box or whatnot, but you see just proximal to the wrist is a bunch of swelling, then you need to think that it could be the bone. And if they're young, then you have to think it's the growth plate because that's where the growth plates are, at the end of the bone. And I think the takeaway is ligaments tend to hurt at the insertion or the origin of the ligament versus the bone. If you've had a growth plate injury, that's the growth plate covers the front, the back, and typically the sides of the bone. So the more circumferential the swelling, the more circumferential the tenderness, the less likely it is going to be an isolated ligament injury.
I'm going to throw 3 nasty words at you. Early sports specialization.
Oh, my ears are ringing.
Right. Unless you're collecting Porsches and Ferraris as an orthopedic surgeon, you probably don't like this.
I don't think there's anything great about it, and I think that it's a push in our society not driven by the elite athletes. So I think if you interview the James Hardens, and which I think recently came out with it, and all of these high-level athletes, none of them had early sports specialization. They were all still doing backyard cup ball and flag football. And it's not that learning the sport at that age is a problem or that people are bad if they do that. It's just you are taxing the body in a very regimented manner, not allowing for as much cross training. And so the same ligament that's always stressed every time is stressed more every time without any type of rest.
Some of the joints that you mentioned, the shoulder and the elbow, specifically little leaguer shoulder and little leaguer elbow, kind of fall within this sports specialization where it's just repetitive trauma, throwing, throwing, throwing. AAU basketball, right? Tournament teams, you have all these different baseball programs that can start you January 1. Being that we're in the South, we can play all the way through December, right?
Yep.
And so some symptoms. You got a kid that's finally complaining, says, you know what, my fastball has no zip, all right? As a parent, I have a four-year-old, soon to be five-year-old. He's going to want to start playing sports, things like that. As a doctor who sees these types mm-hmm. of injuries, you know, early preventative stuff for parents and coaches, things to kind of key in on, but also little leagues themselves, coaches that we send our kids to, what right. is some information that we can kind of take to them or have in our back pocket to make sure we're not put our kids and ourselves at this disadvantage?
Well, I mean, those are all great points. I think the biggest thing is that the parents have to be the advocate, because the kids are playing and they're rewarded for the quality of play and by their peers, by the league. And so it's a little bit of a endorphin, right? I do well. I practice more. I beat other people. People say that I'm doing a great job. I do well. I beat, you know, it's just like it continues. And so a lot of it is on the parents. And then I think probably to be open with the coaches and say, you know what, my child is playing in this little league, is also on a tournament team. So some of it's an awareness. I mean, he's on a tournament team. He plays catcher on the tournament team, or he also pitches on the tournament team. I want to make sure that we are not over-pitching him, because a lot of times the coaches may not be the same coaches on the select-type teams. And, you know, we pick on baseball a lot, but certainly, like you mentioned, it could be basketball, it could be gymnastics, it can be any activity that you're really just taxing the same muscles and just pushing the body to its limits, which is still a fairly fragile system because it's trying to grow and develop. The skeleton of an 8-year-old doesn't look like an adult skeleton. And so when you're going through that metamorphosis, there's less tolerance to some of these problems.
What are we looking for if a kid starts complaining of his shoulder, if he's not just tired, but he may have something more going on?
Yeah, so that's a difficult one, because a lot of these are going to be vague complaints. I think, you know, if you start seeing sometimes loss of enthusiasm, change in pattern, so they're not only are they not throwing as fast, but it looks like they've made some adaptive changes, right? They're changing their arm slot. They're short arming it. Those should be kind of big time red flags. I tell people, I mean, muscle soreness can be normal, right? Kids can hurt just like adults can hurt after they use their muscles. If it's hurting up by the joints, that's to me a little bit more concerning. So I try to tell people, no kid should have elbow pain, right? And no kid should have shoulder pain. Now, there are going to be some exceptions, but if you look at it like that, then all of a sudden you're looking at this kid not saying, oh, yeah, this is probably normal for you. You're looking at it and saying, you know what? Kids shouldn't have elbow pain. What's going on here? At least taking it, you know, through a simple set of questions and saying, "Hey, could this be a more impressive problem?"
And then going down the chain a little bit, now somebody complains on the team of vague knee pain. At that age, playing sports, what do we need to look at? What do we need to consider?
So, great question. I think that typically the young little leaguer age kid, vague knee pain, a lot of times it falls into the category of growing pains, which is probably some mild growth plate irritation for a lot of them. If it's right by their knee, if it's a touchable area, it's a vague knee pain and it's touchable, meaning I can push on an area that's tender, then I'm less concerned. If it's a knee pain, I can't put a finger on it, they're complaining about it, any type of limp, right? If they've had to alter how they're normally walking because of some discomfort, either consciously or subconsciously, that cannot be passed over. And it still may be totally fine, but if they're presenting to you with that, then that needs some formal evaluation. It can be from the hip, and there's some serious problems that can present like that. We talked about a little bit of the older kid, but a slipped capital femoral epiphysis. And we won't see it if it's not picked up on these vague knee pains. And then some intra-articular problems like an osteochondritis dissecans. So some of these cartilage injuries, if you pick up early because you're vigilant about why is this kid, this is not normal, can save him a surgery, can get him back to a normal knee, versus some of these that develop to kind of an early arthritis type knee if it's neglected until they have an unstable piece that now pops off and floats around in the joint.
Are you seeing that if it's not something as severe as OCD, that with rest and recovery they'll bounce back? Is there a time frame that you would consider to be, all right, they've passed this time frame, still having some issues, we need to get this further checked out?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, great question. It's more of a gray zone, and you know, there's not a black and white. I think you know, a lot of times if they don't have an acute injury with a bunch of swelling, I am a proponent of, hey, let's ice this, do some anti-inflammatories, let's see how you feel tomorrow morning. If they're totally normal tomorrow, then again, My concern goes down a little bit. Okay, let's ease you back into it. If it's something identifiable, more surface-related, then I may let them push through it. If they're limping, I'm not giving them too much time before I'm doing a full court press on them.
So that asterisk sign is the limp, right? So they
Correct.
Feel better, but they go back and have some fun, play a sport, and then the limp comes back. That's,
right.
That's a definite sign.
And it doesn't need to be their orthopedic surgeon. It can be a physical therapist that knows musculoskeletal injuries. It can be an athletic trainer. It just needs to be a trained eye that has an understanding. It can be their pediatrician. Just someone more than, you know, oh, that's probably fine. Like you want some objective evaluation. And then, like you suggest, some type of parameters. Hey, it looks fine, but if the limp continues, if we see any swelling, if you're having to give them pain medicine, then this is our action plan. We're going to see our pediatrician. We're going to go see our friend who's a therapist, whatever it is. But you don't want to just get them into this nebulous, and then all of a sudden you look back and you're like, wow, it's kind of been 2 months of limping, right? And we're all guilty of it, but just having that plan will keep you from overlooking it.
So I'm going to give you a little bit of a challenge here. If you were to come up with an infograph for adolescent sports
injuries. I don't even know what an infograph is.
You know, those little the one-page –
Sure.
Blog post that says basically, you know, just little details
okay.
of, you know, epiphyseal injuries or, you know what an infograph is?
I know what it is. I didn't know that's what it's called.
All right. It's basically.
I'm not a blogger.
Well,
okay. I'm old fashioned.
This is really hard for you to answer. All right. A page of.
How about a poster board?
I guess a poster board.
I'm a lot older than you, Ryan. Jeez.
What's the now I can't think of the old word. When you had a book that had all the notes, what are those called?
Cliff notes.
Cliff notes.
Now you're speaking my language.
I reached way back there. All right, you're going to come up with a Cliff Notes handout for coaches
okay.
and parents of adolescent athletes. They
okay.
just said, hey, key in on these few things when it comes to these main joints, ankles,
okay.
elbows, and shoulders, right? What would be some big things on there that you want to put on there, just for, you know, like broad coverage?
Okay. Can I put some philosophical? Can I throw some
pictures,
advice stuff too? Okay. So first thing would be prevention, in just big words,
yeah.
prevention. The second thing would be cross training, multiple sports, right? And that's going to go under prevention. The third thing is rest and unorganized play. Okay, and I think if you follow those first three, a lot of these other ones you're not even going to see. All right, so let's say you got past these first three, then I'm going to say throwing athletes should not have joint pain. Okay, shoulder, elbow are going to be the two big ones, but throwing athletes should not have joint pain. Soreness is okay. The closer to the joint, the more I'm concerned. Rest, anti-inflammatories are okay for a short period. If it persists, it's never normal. Okay, so that would probably cover the upper extremity.
Yeah. Can I throw in there the
sure.
Pitch Smart program?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pitch counts include every throw.
Yeah.
So that needs to be in all bold, right? And then gradual return means gradual, right? There's no such thing as a gradual rocket ship. Okay. And again, these are like life pointers, but these are important things that you're counseling your patients and the parents to help them understand this. A lot of them they're not bad at all. They're enthusiastic parents that love their kids and they want them to do their best and they're excelling and they just need a little bit of coaching so that they can learn how to prevent these injuries. Okay, so I digressed. Acute injuries with swelling, don't blow them off,
yeah.
right? And that can cover your physeal fracture. So a kid that falls on an outstretched arm and has swelling. Swelling, acute injury, and bone tenderness is a fracture until you prove that it's not.
How are you going to differentiate between growing pains and not growing pains? That's typical. A parent, even me growing up, playing sports,
sure.
I heard my grandpa and my dad and my mom, we were like, okay, pain at night, oh, they're growing pains,
yep.
Sip it off, right?
And and you're still fine.
Right.
You're all right.
Yeah, I'm not too bad.
So
from your side of it, what would you say?
So the true definition, growing pains are a diagnosis of exclusion. So you can't make the diagnosis of growing pains. You exclude the other diagnoses and are left with growing pains.
Okay.
That's the hard part of it. Yeah. But I would say typically growing pains, night, lower extremity, vague, not associated with fever, limping, can awake your child. They can be soothed. They go right back to bed. They wake up and they have no symptoms. Those would be the ones I'm safer saying growing pains.
All right. I think that's a good Cliff Notes.
Okay.
Let's move on to our second part of our Power Hour, the athletic hip.
Okay.
All right. And I see this a little bit more in my clinic. A lot of weekend warriors, but also a lot of athletes either returning from previous injury or mm-hmm. let's say, I had one recently, had a patellar fracture, and then he – as we were progressing through return to play, started developing some hip pains and some issues, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about that. But you mentioned, real briefly, mentioned some different common injuries that you see. Can you kind of go over a couple of those that you see that are typically the more athletic populations, the high school athletes, higher
sure.
levels, also up to the weekend warriors and things like that.
So probably the most common, if you look at numbers, which would be a lot that we don't make it to the orthopedic office because they're managed by trainers and therapists and primary care doctors, would be groin pulls, right? So muscle strains at their insertions. And I didn't cover that a whole lot because it's so ubiquitous. But if you just took it by the numbers, strained groin, right? They went lateral, felt a pull, now they're limping, their hip hurts, right? It can be groin. Hip flexor strains. In the younger athletes with the open growth plates, we will see some of the apophysitis or the avulsion fractures. And so that's really kind of the growth plate's a little bit weaker and it's stressed to where it's uncomfortable. And there's some association to vitamin D, so I have to give a shout out to making sure your kids are having vitamin D, especially if they've always got sunscreen on or they're fair complected and they're not out in the sun. And so that can play a role. Or the kids who have been out for an injury, a knee injury, and then they come back and they get back a little bit too fast, and those other joints, even though they're not injured, they've still been in the Bahamas on vacation too, and so they're a little bit out of shape. And so again, the gradual return like a rocket ship is not the way that you can get back.
So, when you have your muscular injuries, things that typically recover with either rest or appropriate conservative care, when you get a little bit deeper, you mentioned the canary and the mine shaft.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give that analogy and then also where that led you?
Sure. So, I was trying to figure out why two patients do fine. Two patients have everything looks the same clinically. One does fine after an intervention. One does terribly after an intervention, and you tackle the same thing. And so when you go down into hip, intra-articular hip pathology, which is kind of what the labrum entails, understanding why this structure that's kind of on the periphery of the socket, that's not necessarily directly loaded in a fairly deep constrained socket, why that tears, why that gets beat up. And so if you think about it as the canary in the mine shaft, it's really not necessarily the primary problem. And if you think of it as not the primary problem, sometimes it will be, but you'll fix the underlying problem. And it may be their pelvic mechanics, right? Their pelvic tilt. It may be their squat mechanics, and it tears the labrum. So if you go in and you swap the canary out, you fix the labrum, and they go down to doing deep squats again, and they tear their labrum again, well, you haven't underdressed the underlying problem.
Right. So underlying problems, let's talk about some of the things that we'll see a lot of athletes, whether it's mm-hmm. running, squatting, we have catchers, you have different positions in different sports that are going to have hockey players, not so much maybe on this side.
Right.
The different skill positions that require the different movements.
Right.
A lot of times I'll see baseball players, mm-hmm. all right, and their lead leg, the one they land on when they're pitching specifically, tends to create some of those issues. Can mm-hmm. you kind of go into the, arthrokinematics of potentially what that could be, but also, just kind of like with the shoulder, when you slowly over age develop that retroversion for leg back, are you having the same areas in that hip doing the same thing where you're having maybe a little bit of different morphology created? Or is it just that repetitive stress and things are starting to get knocked out of the way?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think there was a recent article maybe in the physical therapy literature about potentially the altered growth of the femoral head based on the joint stresses.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we know that quite as definitively as we do, say, in the shoulder literature. But we do believe that the physis, if it's stressed on kind of a sub-threshold level, may broaden in response to that stress. So one theory is the cam deformity or that aspherosity of the femoral head and neck junction can be a response to the mechanical stress. And what that secondarily can do, it can decrease range of motion. And so you see some of these kids that had more internal rotation when they were 9, 10, lose some of that rotation 13, 14. And then it depends on the activities that are required with the motion that you're able to have in a hip. And so if it's your lead leg and you're rotating and basically internally rotating the leg and flexing, you're doing that fader maneuver. And so if you have decreased motion as you progress and if your pitching exceeds that subclinical threshold, then you may be at risk for problems.
So kind of connecting two points here, repetitive stress, kind of mentioned that cam deformity is – and then that kind of takes us to, category of FAI. Is it repetitive stress that creates those morphologies? Are you born with those morphologies? What's your opinion?
So, you're based on the imaging that we've followed. You're not born with it, but it develops in adolescence, and there's some evidence that we have serial radiographs, and you can see this progressive growth of the cam. And a lot of times you see that corresponds with the physis. As the physis elongates distally down the neck and then you get bone growth, then you're going to get that abnormal spherosity. That's one theory. It's really hard to prove. And we think sometimes it's this kind of post-traumatic, subclinical. And then the tough part is if you're really trying to kind of pin it down and say why are some people painful and some not, you have to look at neck shaft angle. You have to look at femoral anaversion or retroversion, and then you have to look at acetabular coverage, which can be a dynamic target based on pelvic incidence and how they walk and what activities they do. And so, I think that's why you see the anatomy and the morphology, but you don't see it. You don't see an injury every time.
So the genetics, somebody who's predisposed to be able to squat deep. It's not that they just keep practicing squatting and that's why they can do it into their 60s. It's that they were built and aligned appropriately for it.
Right, and there's some self-selection. For instance, a lot of the dancers are borderline dysplastic. Not sure if dancing makes them borderline dysplastic, but probably if you're 10 or 11 years old and you're trying to do 100 leg lifts up to your ear and you can't get midway, you're probably not going to continue to be a dancer, and the ones that can are going to then continue to excel, and then now you've just sub-selected out this group that has a similar morphology because they can complete the tasks that they need to complete to get to advance.
So a retroverted acetabulum
mm-hmm.
allows for a decent squat, right?
So it would be an anaverted acetabulum would allow for a decent squat or a shallow acetabulum. So if it's retroverted, you're going to impinge earlier, so that's going to give you decreased flexion.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Okay. So then do the opposite. Retroverted for sprinters. I've heard that when you have that excessive extension, right, you can have a longer, a further pull through. You have that hyperextension of the hip, right? And then when you have that clear coverage, you see that perfect front squat. And then those are the people that don't have that anterior hip pain going into the deep. All right. I've kind of heard, Tyson Gay.
Okay.
Right? Was an interesting kind of segment. He said he never really enjoyed squatting, but he really was good at deadlifting. And then, if you follow strength training and things like that, Brett Contreras has a hip thrust exercise.
Okay.
It's basically they call it a horizontal squat. So it's primarily just gluteal extension, but he says going into the hip hyperextension allows you to get that full pull through of the muscle. So I'm just kind of curious if you feel like maybe just the morphology of it, of the hip, has allowed these people, to, like you said, the dancer who can't kick past 90 pretty much stops it, but the
right
sprinters who then have that, you know, that predisposition for those ranges allow them to progress further in their sport.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not familiar with the answer to that question, but I mean, that's a brilliant question. I mean, I think you do see kind of the higher incidence in some of these athletes, and so you wonder, right, what's the natural history if we took everybody versus these super select populations? But I'm sure there's a comment, right? It's nature and nurture, and part of nature is how you're built, and then nurture is how you're, you know, how you train with how you're built. So I'm sure there has some factor with it.
Before we move on, you said one of the most important things we can take away from your talk was a skiffy.
Yes.
I'm going to give you a soapbox.
Okay. All right. So a slipped capital femoral epiphysis, and I'll call it a skiffy, is the condition that timing of diagnosis matters. So if I'm delayed a little bit on a groin pull, not really a huge deal, right? Some time lost. If I'm delayed on FAI 3 months, right, the natural history is that it doesn't progress that quickly. But a slipped capital femoral epiphysis is an entity that the time is ticking, and the opportunity for someone to develop irreversible changes to their hip is moving as time moves. And so any adolescent, mainly they're obese, but any adolescent 8 to 14 years of age with vague knee pain, the hip pains are easier because you're going to be thinking hip, but it's the knee pain and you're not thinking hip. If they have vague knee pain, just spend the extra 10 seconds, check their hip range of motion, watch them walk, make sure they're not externally rotated in their gait. And if they have that, you got to think about it. And if you're thinking about it and their motion's abnormal and the picture fits, this is an urgent referral. This is not, let me call my friend and get them in 2 or 3 weeks. This is, I can't get you in to see somebody today. You're going to the emergency room. Because if it's missed or delayed, and we've had therapists for 6 weeks treat it, we've had orthopedic surgeons do a surgery on their knee, because it's knee pain. I mean, it is knee pain, and to everyone around them, it's knee pain. But the origin of that knee pain is the hip. And that her whole referred pain concept, it's similar to a spine condition, right, where they have radiculopathy and their foot is burning, but it's because of the back. So it's that same thing. And they've had treatments, and then they have a misstep at school, and now they can't walk, and their hip hurts, and it's an oh, it was actually the hip. And that can lead to avascular necrosis, which the only good option in that population is a hip replacement or a hip fusion. Neither of those are great for athletics.
And that kind of takes me to the next point. I've been lucky enough to be involved with your hip preservation program.
Yes.
Can you expound on that a little bit for the trainers and therapists who are interested in a little bit more into the hip but also just don't know much about it?
Yeah, so I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to start a collaborative effort with Ryan and certainly some of the therapists, Chris Juno, Emily Gardner, Brian Duncan, Talal, Laquita. The list goes on. I've had such great enthusiasm. And what's really awesome is it's a collaborative effort because I think there's so many of these hip pathologies that are not surgeon-based. And even admittedly, I'm not the expert at the treatment of some of them. And you know what? It's okay to say that. And it's okay to say, I know who to plug you into and get you to the right spot so we can treat the underlying problem. And it's been a collaborative effort, both on kind of the research front has been picking up, but the educational piece and saying, you know what, we've educated our therapists. They're dedicated to this as a part of their practice. And we think that they're differentiating themselves by taking better care of patients with hip pain. And that's really the goal. The goal of this program is to form a collaborative effort so the patient wins. And I think that we don't want to see the patients with either the wrong treatment, be it surgical or non-surgical. And they're lingering in this kind of, you know, I've had hip pain and nobody can figure it out. When we have kind of a dedicated team that hopefully can put our minds together and move things forward. So it's been great. It's been a collaborative effort between Memorial Hermann and UT. And so it's awesome to see in this day and age of medicine where a lot of kind of one-offs, me, own little silos, to really see a bunch of people with a common goal get together and then elevate the level of care that's being given to the Houston and you know, surrounding area. So
if somebody kind of is interested or they feel like they need a more in-depth examination, how can we get in contact with you?
So probably easiest way is through an email address. So it's alfred.a.mansour at uth.tmc.edu. And, you know, we, as well as our PT partners, are open to shadowing. You know, it's something we're excited about. We're happy to spread it. We have protocols that have come out in a collaborative effort as well. We have website information that you can look us up and can give more information to. And that's those are probably the best ways for sure. And we have some educational sessions that have been largely put on by our therapy team that are a great way to get more info.
Thank you very much for this time, guys. If you want to look at this presentation again, follow it up at sportsmedbroadcast.com/Mansour 2018. Thank you, sir.
Awesome. Thank you.